versus Imo Clardy et al. Mr. Segrist, you're up.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please this honorable court, I'm George McCall Segrist, Jr. from Houston. I represent Christina Clardy on appeal. I'd like to focus with the court's indulgence on points of errors 4 and 5. We believe reversible error was committed by the district court in refusing both to offer oral limiting instructions throughout the course of the trial, and then finally in the court's jury instruction at the conclusion of the evidence with respect to the fact that ample evidence of Medicare and Medicaid regulatory noncompliance did not necessarily equate to criminal conduct, and cautioning the jury that appropriate consideration of that evidence was limited solely to issues of intent, knowledge, and motive. As the court knows from a review of the record, this is a criminal trial wherein the record literally is permeated with evidence and testimony of the Medicare and Medicare regime, the rules and regulations, and opinions by a host of government witnesses that Dr. Clardy violated the same.
No less. You think there's overkill here in terms of the regulations, that the jury got into the regulatory violations and that steered them away from the elements?
Well, I do in this sense, and this is where I want to disabuse the government, is contrary to its position, we're not taking a position on appeal that this is a U.S. versus Christo case. The evidence of Medicare and Medicaid regulatory noncompliance was relevant. The issue is, though, what did it become unduly prejudicial without the court offering limiting instructions? Again, if we look at this case, you're talking 6 government witnesses over a span of hundreds of pages of testimony. These witnesses are both expert witnesses and lay witnesses, and as cataloged in my footnote 17 of the opening brief, a host of government written exhibits were introduced into evidence, and these witnesses ad nauseum relied and specifically addressed the specific regulatory requirement and opined over and over and over again that Dr. Clardy had violated those regulations, even suggesting that she committed fraud because of those violations. Defense counsel repeatedly asked for limiting instructions. The trial court refused to give the same. The mantra of the prosecutor was that the judge is going to tell the jury at the end of the trial what the constituent elements of the offenses are, so there's no reason to give a limiting instruction. At the conclusion of the trial, again, defense counsel was very specific and asked for the giving of a limiting instruction. The trial court was adamant, respectfully, but adamant that she was not going to give the Christo instruction.
Well, you were not defense counsel, right?
I was not defense counsel at trial, Your Honor.
Is there any evidence that defense counsel couldn't make this representation, make this explanation to the jury? Or when he's cross-examining witnesses, wasn't he at liberty to make this explanation himself rather than asking the court to give
I think a fair reading of the record is that defense counsel attempted to do that from time to time throughout trial, but
it's pretty consistent.
Well, it is, and yet it certainly doesn't. It doesn't take the place of an affirmative instruction by a sitting United States District Court telling the jury, not as a partisan, but as the judge of the law, what the rules and regulations are here.
Right, but the trial judge doesn't need to tell the jury what the crime is not comprised of. He needs to tell the jury what the components and elements of the crime are, what they need to find, not what they don't need to find or what isn't relevant.
Well, I beg to differ only in this sense, is that this court, in a host of cases, they're all in the brief, but Park, Brechtel, Harvard, has stated, Cordell has stated over and over again that the trial court did not err in allowing relevant admissible evidence into the record because the trial court cautioned the jury throughout the trial as to the limited purpose for which the jury was to make for that evidence. That's what this court has held time and time again. In this case, what is particularly problematic, and I brought it to the attention of the court as an officer of the court, U.S. v. Jones, which the government never relied on. In Jones, a panel of this court held that the boilerplate instruction that's given in every case, that the defendant is not on trial for any act, conduct, or offense not alleged in the indictment, somehow was enough to protect the defendant. Of course, the Jones case is totally different from Myers. In Jones, for a number of reasons. Number one, in our indictment, in fact, Medicare and Medicaid regulations are indicted. The prosecutor talked about Medicare and Medicare. I'm sorry?
They're not indicted, they're included.
They're included in the indictment,
right.
Yes, but specific reference is made to Medicare and Medicare regulations in the indictment.
That's how you commit the crime.
Well, there's plenty of healthcare fraud indictments I have seen where they did not allege in the indictment the actual Medicare regulations, rather they allege the constituent elements of the healthcare fraud case. I'm not contending that the government can't allege it, but this is a case where, in fact, Medicare, Medicaid regulations are in the indictment. They're discussed in opening statement. They're discussed in the final argument. The jury is given utterly no guidance as to what the appropriate use of such testimony is. And that runs counter, again, to all the cases that we cited. And this is not a situation, I think what's important, at least from my perspective, for the court to understand, unlike United States versus Park, one of the cases I relied on, I think the record 700 pages, total testimony relative to this issue was 13 pages, and it was not discussed thereafter. In our case, it permeates this record. That's the best word for it. It's there over and over and over again.
But what's the rule you're looking for, though? I mean, how long was this trial?
This trial lasted about 3 weeks.
Okay, so we're talking about a 3-week trial with whatever the number of witnesses is, a pretty big volume. Of course, I haven't read the record, but I mean, there's a lot of evidence to spread over a lot of time. I get your point, but surely you're not pressing for some kind of quantitative limitation by the court to say in a X case, you know, the government can make some prima facie showing of regulation, yada, yada, but, you know, when you get past X, you know, that's too much. I know you're not urging that. I know you're not.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying in the scheme of a huge trial, lots of witnesses, et cetera, that's getting way down into the discretion of the trial judge in terms of managing the trial. Not that your point isn't salient, but it's kind of like, you know, like what are you asking the Fifth Circuit to hold? When did it transcend to be reversible error in the case? If so, I mean, when did it move past they can show the backdrop and it moved to reversible error so that this court should say on this record this became prejudicial?
I think obviously a fair question, Chief Judge Stewart, and let me answer it this way, is I'm not asking for any kind of quantitative ruling from the court. I'm just saying that it seems to me the plain reading of your precedent is that when you have this type of case, a federal criminal action where you have federal regulatory noncompliance evidence, that at the very least the trial court should orally admonish the jury at the beginning of the trial, cautioning them as to what is getting ready to happen and the limited use to which they can make of that evidence is once enough.
Not being facetious with your question, but just allow for the possibility we could affirm past what you're saying and drop a footnote in the opinion saying, by the way, it's a better practice for the trial judge to give a limited instruction, yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, sure, that's not going to satisfy you.
Well, it's not. I'm just saying in this case, You know, all I can do is look at the court's precedent. If you
no, 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 I understand, and I get your point. I'm just saying from here, you're before the Fifth Circuit, we didn't try it. I mean, the argument made to the trial judge to say, right, do this, trial judge didn't. But here, we're looking at the fully tried case and the mass of all the cases that are tried, and that's right, what I'm saying. Okay, are you really asking us to hold that surely a predicate can be laid with the regulations, but when the government chooses to put the regulations in the indictment, it can only go this far so that a trial judge knows or not. Now, I'm having trouble discerning, you know, what the principle would be in such a holding, because we don't, to take your point, we'd have to say it was reversible error in this case in the context of all the other evidence that was presented.
I think, you know, obviously each case has to stand or fall on its own merits. I say, though, when you have a healthcare fraud case where you have repeated references in the evidence, both oral and in writing, to Medicare, Medicaid, noncompliance, that the trial court, as a general proposition, should certainly offer oral admonition at least once, if not more. Your precedent has cases where judges have done it after every witness or before. But at least there has to be some oral admonition, right, and certainly at the conclusion of the trial.
All right, well, let me take you there, because we've got your point on the other, but there, let's go to the end of the trial. All right, was there a proffered instruction from defense counsel at the bar? Your Honor, we've asked during the trial to do this. Your Honor has not done it, so we hear proffered that you give this limit. Was there a proffered instruction that the judge declined?
There was. In fact, it quoted, I believe I'm not out of line when I tell the court it quoted the precedent verbatim. It cited other circuit court precedent in an instruction that had been affirmed on appeal, and offered that to the court for the jury instruction that ought to be included. The trial court refused. Again, I don't take any personally, but she refused out of line. I'm not going to give a Christo instruction. Have a nice day. The record is clear. The government seemed to suggest to the contrary, but the record is clear that Judge Harmon stated that if it's not in the jury instruction, then all your specifically requested instructions have been denied.
All right, I think we've got you on there, so it's not tape. Did you want to shift to the other point, or I'm not telling you to stop on that, but I think we understand, you know, what your argument, both on the within trial and—
Yes, Your Honor. The other issue that I'd like to bring to the trial court's attention is I believe that reversible error was committed by the trial court allowing the prosecution to cross-examine defendant Clardy as to specific acts of alleged misconduct. Motion limine had been filed. A discussion had taken place outside the presence of the jury, actually prior to the commencement of trial. The prosecutor said that the alleged extraneous matter would only be used in the cross-examination of character witnesses. In fact, defendant Clardy did not put on any character witnesses, and in cross-examination, the prosecutor was allowed to ask questions which we believe were clearly inadmissible, not appropriate. There was nothing in her testimony that opened the door to this.
Let me ask you something specific. Yes, Your Honor. Before you run out of time.
Sure.
Tell me the significance, or what was argued by the government as to the significance of the letter alerting her to the fact that prescriptions were being sold on the street, the fact that it was in a safe. Was it the fact that it was hidden in a safe, or was the allegation, or the maybe it was the defense that, oh, I was keeping it in the safe to keep it safe so I knew where it was, or was there an evil motive of concealment?
I don't require actually specific argument as to that. I require the prosecution suggesting that Dr. Clardy had been on notice of that and it had not gone to the constabulary with it. He said, you knew about it, you didn't go to the constabulary. Her response was, I just found out about it. I only had the letter in my presence for a very short period of time by the time that the agents came into the house and took it. I don't recall
so
really.
Just the existence of the letter, not the fact that it had been concealed in a safe.
I could be wrong, but I don't recall any suggestion or argument by the prosecutor that the fact that it was in a safe was somehow nefarious in any way.
Okay.
But again, the bottom line is direct representation was made by the prosecution that they'd only use this extraneous matter in cross-examination of character witnesses. And it seemed to me the record is clear that was the agreement, if you will, and in fact they didn't use it for that limited purpose. And as the record reflects in final argument, the prosecutor spoke about it at some length, as well as the Medicare and Medicaid regulatory noncompliance.
Mr. Sechrist, I'm going to give you, Madam Clerk, give him 2 minutes. I'm going to give you 2 minutes. It's a big case any other point, and I'll give the government additional time if she needs it, the two on the other side. So you got 2 minutes on the House.
Well, the only thing I want to do, and I can't, and you're very gracious, Your Honor, I appreciate it. I can't do it in 2 minutes, but I wanted to just let the court know this. I have raised legal insufficiency as to all counts of conviction. And I believe that a fair reading of the record, I think that's an honest argument. But the reason that I want to just address it briefly at this juncture is that I believe in my heart of hearts that by not providing any limiting instruction, either orally or in the final charge to the jury, in the context of this case, with the repeated reference to regulatory noncompliance on the part of Dr. Clardy, that ultimately, I believe that's error. The question, of course, $23 question in every case, is it harmful error? And it's certainly my belief that, of course, the burden of proving harmlessness is on the government, that this offensive testimony permeates the record, and I don't believe the evidence, while I believe the evidence is legally insufficient, if the court were to disagree with me about that, I would suggest to the court that the evidence certainly is not overwhelming. And when you engaged, I think as you ultimately must, in a harmless error analysis, that I would say this with all respect, that you should find that certainly it had a substantial influence on the jury's verdict in this case, especially in light of the evidence that came in relative to my client as opposed to the other two co-defendants. And that's the last thing I'd like to say. Thank
all
you so much.
All right, you've reserved time for rebuttal.
I appreciate your
thank you. You're welcome. All right, we'll hear from the government. Ms. Wilson.
May it please the court. The district court in the instant case did not violate its substantial discretion in rejecting the limiting instruction. As this court has recognized, the government would be hard-pressed to prove health care fraud without referring to regulations. Here, the government did not bootstrap the regulatory violations to establish the criminal elements. It never argued they were coterminous. And the district court was in the best position to evaluate whether an instruction was necessary. And here, the court determined that it would confuse the jury. And it's important to bear in mind that while regulations were discussed, over this three-week period, there were also 29 witnesses. So it wasn't just these six or seven that defense counsel referenced. Again, 29 witnesses, that's a substantial number of people testifying. And the fact that the jury did not blindly apply the regulatory violations to the criminal accounts is established by its verdict. Only Emo was convicted on all counts. Clardy was not, and Anacam was not. And in fact, Dr. Hume was acquitted. So the jury obviously followed the court's instructions here. And as this court said in Cristo, if the government can prove criminal elements, it doesn't matter that the acts also violate civil regulatory statutes. But even assuming that this court here thinks that an instruction should be submitted, to prevail, the defense counsel has to prove that there was substantial doubt, or rather, this court has to find that there was substantial doubt that the jury was properly guided. And here, you have to look at the charge as a whole, and it correctly stated the law and instructed the jurors. And but for that limiting instruction, the defense has no complaints about the submission of the charge. And the charge is rather thick because there were, I don't know how many counts, but 40, 50, something along those lines. They don't have any complaints about that. Their only complaint is about this instruction. But the jury was repeatedly instructed by the district court to make its decision based on the evidence in the law and in the charge and not to stray from the indictment. So the jury, of course, was not invited to look elsewhere to find, to determine guilt. Whether you turn to Jones or any of these other cases, this court repeatedly has talked about how court's instructions are fine where the jury is counseled to follow the charge. And I didn't say that as eloquently as I could, but I think this court understands my point. And one thing that's important to say here is that the defense submitted two instructions. One was a Christo-type instruction, but the other instruction wasn't substantially correct, which was part of its burden. And it actually highlighted and incorporated Medicare and Medicaid violations and regulations as elements of proof. Here, the indictment and the charge talked about the scheme to defraud. Defraud whom? Medicare and Medicaid. It wasn't talking about the regulations. It talks about what the jury had to find in relation to the criminal counts. The defense here can't show that the failure to give this proposed instruction seriously impaired their effective defense. To my knowledge, they were able to put on whatever defense they saw fit. They also can't, in my opinion, they also can't prove prejudice or that it affected the outcome. There's ample evidence.
Did defense counsel argue, about the regulation? In other words, did defense counsel couch in closing argument, if you will, the lack of viability of the regulations, the matter of which the judge wouldn't give a charge? Did defense counsel push that either in terms of cross-examination of witnesses and or in the closing argument?
I think defense counsel was fairly assertive in relation to defending its clients in relation to the specific counts. And as I said in my brief, the way this initially came up, or certainly the greatest discussion of where it came up, was their objections to certain exhibits, which was preceding the trial. And then when they started the trial, there was evidence, but their objections were sometimes sporadic. And I didn't get into a plain error situation because I don't think that's fair here. I don't think it's correct. But my point simply is the regulations were part and parcel of this case. But that's not to say they were bootstrapped to establish criminal liability, because this is a healthcare fraud case. So, of course, there would be some discussion of that. The point here is that they can't establish prejudice by virtue of the fact there was ample evidence of the criminal conduct, so much so that neither Emo nor Anacam has raised a sufficiency point. There was a lot of evidence against those two individuals. And while Clardy does raise a sufficiency point, the jury's findings are supported by both circumstantial evidence and direct evidence. Each person had a role in this conspiracy here. And Clardy's was to apply for a provider number and then allow CNS, City Nursing, to obtain money from Medicare and Medicaid. Without her, the scheme would not have worked because they needed that provider number. And then she didn't try to terminate the fraud, and she didn't report the fraud. Instead, she contributed to it. And the jury made its decision based on a paper trail of Clardy's involvement. On May 10, 2006, Clardy knew CNS would be billing under her provider number. The court can find that in Exhibit 1A1 on page 258, as well as I said in my brief, in various places in the record. The same day, she signed two employment agreements, but only one was submitted to Medicare. 2 months later, she signed on as the medical care director. And as I set forth in my brief, there's a lot of evidence supporting all of that. But even if you assume, which the jury rejected, that some of these documents were forged, what we know is no later then July of 2006, she knew about the fraud because she sent the cease and demand letter to EMO. And what she said is, stop. You need to stop using my provider number. You need to tell Medicare. You need to resubmit. And if you don't do all these things, I'm going to report it. But the only thing that changed after that is she started working more. And over the next year, before she quit, Medicare and Medicaid were billed $22 million.
Well, was she working more or just being paid more?
She was actually working more as well. But it was $22 million. She never followed up with EMO in relation to whether he had followed up on any of her demands in the cease and desist letter. And more importantly, she didn't report the fraud herself. So we have that paper trail. We also have the bank records that show she started getting paid, and her sister was paid even more. And if you look in relation to the testimony from the FBI agent and the IRS agent, you'll see there was tandem in relation to the amounts going up and things of that nature. But what we also saw is the patient files told Clardy and the jury that people weren't receiving physical therapy and that there was no licensed physical therapist on the premises. And remember, this is supposed to be a physical therapy client. The jury also saw pictures and videos of people just sitting around this tiny little office waiting to be paid. There was no real physical therapy taking place, and while one witness did say that the paying the individuals, the alleged patients, was somewhat hidden from the doctors, other witnesses talked about getting paid in other rooms that were more in open view. And Clardy's own testimony said that she would sometimes walk into the therapy room or the exercise room or things of that nature. So in addition to the paper trail, we also have the witnesses, including Clardy herself. And the jury simply wasn't convinced by her sweeping denials of knowledge, her allegedly faulty memory, feeble explanations about these files, or direct contradictions of others' testimony and the documentary evidence. Dr. Clardy was not naive. This was her third Medicare provider number since 1999. She had known EMO since 2000 or 2001. He even went to her house a couple times. One time was before they engaged in this business, and the other time was the evening of the night that the night he received the cease and desist letter. Clearly, this wasn't some employer-employee relationship that was at arm's length. And her sister.
How long did this go on?
Pardon me?
How long was it documented that this went on in the indictment?
Well, she joined the conspiracy in 2006, but in relation to proving up the loss amounts and things like that, to be fair, what the government did is we narrowed it to the time that she sent the demand letter, the cease and desist letter, in July of 2007 to the following year. So we didn't look at the prior $8 million.
Well, where are the Medicare inspectors or the regulators or the people who are supposed to make sure this isn't happening?
That's an excellent question and one that I personally can't answer. I have asked that question, and I think, like many other agencies, they're completely overwhelmed. And the way that the Medicare and Medicaid works, as I set out in the brief, is when we go to a doctor, it's somewhat like our insurance. The provider doesn't have to, or the billing person doesn't have to submit the documentary backup. What they get is some type of bill, if you will, for what is submitted, a person, a time, the amount of time, and particular codes.
So there's no inspection to make sure that a physical therapy clinic is actually functioning?
There was no testimony.
Total license to steal, obviously, $28 million worth.
There was no testimony in that regard, Your Honor. I believe that now with technology being what it is, it's getting easier to target that type of thing because there were certain codes. Medicare has certain caps, and if you go over them, you employ certain codes, and that's the way that some of this was starting to be figured out.
So there was no evidence that this scheme involved paying off inspectors or paying off...
Absolutely none. There was no evidence of that whatsoever.
Just blatant incompetence.
Yes, Your Honor. I agree. And I think what they finally figured out is that these therapy codes frequently were beyond what the average person receives for physical therapy, meaning like the number of hours and the types of codes, because the periodically you need these modifiers if you're going to go beyond certain caps. And I think that's important to understand how it works, but it's not relevant essentially to the disposition here for this court. So in any event, her sister is the one who worked before. From what I can tell from the record, Dr. Clardy pretty much got her sister the job. The sister lived in Austin, but she lived with Dr. Clardy when she would come into town and work there. And at one time, as I pointed out in the brief, one of the witnesses saw her checking a Medicare fraud website. And when the witness said something, when she was questioned about it, the sister, Dr. Katharina, said, oh, well, we should be okay because they would go after Emo. So it's hard to believe that Dr. Clardy lived in this bubble and didn't do anything. And the jury, I believe, clearly figured all of this out. In relation to Mr. Sechrest's last point, unless this court has some additional questions, the district court didn't abuse its discretion in allowing the cross-examination of Clardy's specific act of misconduct. By testifying, she put her character for truthfulness in issue, and the government was entitled to ask about her prior bad acts. The district court protected against any prejudice here with a limiting instruction, both before Clardy testifying and then again in the charge. And that instruction spoke to Clardy's character for honesty and truthfulness. And so the testimony was supposed to go no further than that. And so to that extent.
What was her baseline defense? She didn't know what was going on?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
She testified. I assume she was on the stand for a good while. So, I mean, what was her principal defense? That she was unaware?
Yes, that she didn't know that physical therapy was being performed, and all these other witnesses more or less said that it was not. What they had going on is people applying hot packs and massage, but that is not physical therapy. That's not reimbursable physical therapy. Plus, in order to be reimbursed, you have to have a licensed physical therapist on the premises. And there was a certificate on the wall showing that the alleged licensed physical therapist was not. He was an aide or something of that nature.
But I assume, based on what you said, this was her third Medicare license, she was asked on the stand and presumably acknowledged what all the requisite requirements were, i.e., you know, that there needed to be a physical therapist on premises. Said, in other words, is it correct? She didn't deny, oh, I didn't know that we had
yes.
to do this.
Well, she said she was duped, that it had been represented to her that this particular fellow, I don't know how to pronounce his name, Niziocha, was a physical therapist, but his certificate said otherwise. And also, the other person who was allegedly doing physical therapy was one of the former drivers who would go out and pick up people from halfway houses and things of that nature to bring them in. And she, as I recall, knew that. And so you typically aren't elevated from a driver of a van to providing physical therapy. In any event, to the extent the court disagrees that should have been gone into, any error is harmless here. Her conviction is based on a plethora of evidence. And most of this evidence is what she engineered, either through her oral testimony or through documents that she or her attorney signed. So unless this court has any additional questions, I will yield the remainder of my time.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Wilson. Mr. Sechrest, you have rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to make sure that we're all on the same page. The objections that defense counsel made with respect to the admissibility of the regulatory evidence and a specific request for a limiting instruction were more than adequate to preserve error here, contrary to the government's suggestion.
Well, she's not asserting plain error. I mean, I gathered she was saying, you know, arguably that could be there, but they haven't alleged that the objections weren't properly considered, so we're not going to
thank you, Judge.
Go down that road. That's
good. Again, the And she also mentioned there were two different requests for special instructions in the court's written jury instruction. That's true. But the one that I'm referencing and the error that I believe befell Dr. Clardy was specific and referenced cases that are right on point, which adequately put the trial court on notice as to the necessity of providing a limiting instruction. The government also suggests, well, you know, no harm, no foul, because the jury was able to get it right because they didn't convict Dr. Clardy of every count. That's a typical argument, and it holds no water, because the evidence is clear that the counts for which Dr. Clardy was acquitted represent conduct that allegedly took place after she had left the employ of the clinic. This is a 40-month long conspiracy, as alleged in the indictment. Dr. Clardy is associated with these folks for a little less than 12 months. She sees 100 and something clients out of 1,300. She's paid a very small amount of money, something like $130,000 over the compared to the $30 million that was billed. She had no ownership interest. This business about she signed certain documents, the evidence is unrefuted that her signature was forged. She, in fact, did alert the...
What was forged? Not the prescription?
No, the initial document that had to be filled out in order to start the clinic. You have to have a physician in charge.
The medical doctor.
Yes, Your Honor. That was shown to be a forgery after, and the government never, you know, they didn't bother to seek the use of a forgery expert, never questioned the expert that was called who testified.
Sounds like potent jury argument, Mr. Sechrist.
Well, that's true. That's true. But the reality is the evidence shows that Dr. Clardy had left working for this establishment, and her PTAN, her physician billing number, was used over and over again after she left. And in fact, to answer your question, Judge Clement, evidence shows that one of the government witnesses who worked for a predecessor entity had suspected fraud at this location 2 years before, but did nothing about it. And the evidence is clear that Dr. Clardy did alert them about the fraud, but apparently she didn't fill out the right forms enough times, even though she provided enough information to put everybody on notice as to what was going on. The government says that without the limiting instruction, that the jury nonetheless was able to understand how it was to use the evidence. I believe that is absolutely belied by the record.
But you don't take the position the jury couldn't understand what was being charged here as the crime, do you?
I think the jury understood what was being charged. I assume that they followed Judge Harmon's instructions with respect to the constituent elements, Judge Stewart. But again, they're given no guidance as to the limited purpose for which all this admissible but prejudicial evidence was admitted. They're given no guidance as to how it's to be used. They're not told that, in fact, the existence of regulatory noncompliance in and of itself doesn't constitute a crime. They're not told that. There's nothing given to them that helps them to use that evidence for the very limited purpose for which it was admitted.
The government copy of the indictment in the jury room?
You know, I was thinking about that this morning. I don't want to mislead you, Your Honor. I don't recall. I believe that was discussed in the record, but I can't tell you, and I wasn't there as one of the advocates to let you know that it went in. So I'm sorry, I can't answer the question. One question the government hasn't answered is, and I've argued again, Rule 105. Rule 105 specifically addresses the need for limiting instructions and that the proponent is entitled to one. And the government turns a blind eye to that argument as well. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you, counsel, for both sides. We have your full briefing and your argument. We'll take the case under submission.
Thank you.